After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
A big part of the advocacy around neurodiversity is to say, no, different isn't less. It's just different. Mm-hmm. And there are so many beautiful strengths about it.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I am back. And I'm back with someone that's, how long have we known each other? Nicole? Not that long, right?
Not that long. Maybe 2 years since I've been going to the Maui retreats.
Oh, yes. So I met her through Ram Dass, as I meet most people through Ram Dass over the years, Nicole Tetrol. And tell me just a little bit about how you even came to the point where, Nicole is a neuroscientist, everybody, and has a wonderful book that from a couple of years ago, and it encompasses neuroscience. And what I want to get at today is the way in which we can take this kind of information, which has a scientific undercurrent, shall we say, and nomenclature and so on that people get nervous about. But there's stuff in here that I think can really help us all. You don't have to have any real acumen around the sciences, but the reality is things can change. And that's what Nicole and I were just talking about. And she was about to say, even with you at your age, you can still probably change a little bit. How did you even get to any kind of interest? And I know you have an interesting childhood.
My interest in neuroscience really started when I was 18. My mom was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. So it's a neurodegenerative disease where you lose motor neurons. And over time, it becomes a global experience in the brain because everything is connected. And so for me, I really came into neuroscience wanting to reduce suffering for her. Suffering for people who were dealing with Parkinson's, which led me to kind of my studies where I transitioned a little bit out of Parkinson's research because it was a little bit too heavy when I was at UCLA, and I moved over to Caltech and focused my studies on autism. And what I found is that there are a lot of similarities when we're looking at the brain and we're thinking about neuroinflammation and we're thinking about social connection and our reward systems and how we just process life and how much inflammation was related to the experience. On top of it, at the same time, I was diagnosed with cancer myself. When I was in graduate school.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't.
Yeah.
They told me.
And when I was diagnosed with cancer, I had a one-year-old. I was at UCLA, and I pretty much wanted to drop out. I was in really deep depression. And I showed up, and I landed in the psychologist's office. And they did a workup, and basically, when I said I was in this deep depression, they kind of like blew me off about it and said, I'm going to send you to a psychiatrist. I think you need medication. And I landed in the psychiatrist's office and they did you know, I explained everything I was dealing with. And I was like, do you think I'm bipolar? Am I crazy? You know, I started, you know, started to believe it. And she looked at me and it was like this doorway of compassion where she said, you're suffering. You're in this depths of suffering and everything you're experiencing is absolutely normal. And I have two options for you. One, I could start giving you medication to go to sleep to help you out. Two, we have UCLA Mark here and I'd like you to start doing meditation. And that was really the doorway that started to transform my relationship with suffering, where going in it as a scientist, it was all about a fixing model rather than sitting with and bearing witness. And that became kind of really pivotal later on, because when my mother was in the very late stages of Parkinson's, and I had, you know, I had finished my PhD program and she had about 3 months left to live, and I declined academic positions to be with her and to sit with her and transition and become a science writer and a communicator, and really honor to her, because I felt like by the time like a scientific study happens, it takes about 7 years before the public even knows. And so I really wanted to be able to be that doorway for people to use what they needed from scientific information, and communicate that, as well as like let go of what doesn't work for you. And so it was a big shift in my life. And when that happened was I was still at that time suffering from a lot of anxiety. Like my fear circuitry was just on fire.
Is this related to the cancer?
It was related to my mom dying. So death in a different way, right? Not my personal death, but I mean, I guess there are deaths that you have when somebody else passes, because the memories of them, your connection together is that physical presence is gone, even though the memories still live. But it was really my coming together with how, when my mom was, you know, transitioning and kind of every single baseline, you know, she was in a wheelchair, not very different than Ram Dass, you know, for her last years. And there were so many different baselines being her daughter that I had to come to terms with, that, you know, I'm not going to hike with her again. I'm not going to, you know, be able to do certain activities. You know, an amazing thing we got to do was swim in a pool, you know, where she was weightless. But one thing that I always would do was take her food. I would visit her and bring her meals. And this one time I was just nervously, you know, preparing food for her. And at the time I was in graduate school, you know, very restricted budget, but I would go all out and get her kind of the nicest food I can get her. And I was in the kitchen and I just remember nervously preparing it and her saying, stop, stop. Just sit and hold my hand. And sitting with her was really a transformative experience, because she started to hold my hand and say, I know, I know, I know. And it was the first time of like really being aware of bearing witness of that suffering in real time, you know, rather than it being a thought or, you know, this is a feeling or this is an emotion, but it was like bearing witness together, like, okay, we're doing this thing and this is how we're going to do it. And so it just changed me, because I said, I'm going to be with her through this. And it became a living meditation being with her as she transitioned.
No. You know, they say that everybody, of course, has parents, and most of the time, you will be going through a transition with one of them, if not both. And that opportunity is humongous in terms of relating with death, birth, and the, you know, complete, absolute rule of thumb, which is impermanence. And to, then you can start to live with it, you know, well before you're going to go through the bardos. So that's pretty amazing, Nicole.
Yeah, and I love what you said, though, how it's this layering of impermanence and that also remembering to be present, right? Like how we have these doorways and these opportunities, and we don't really know all the lessons and the why our parents, but it does create who we are. And like, even scientifically, you know, when we think about ancestors, you know, their DNA imprints of different types of trauma, you know, come into our physiology, and just how that all plays. Sorry, I didn't mean to be like so heavy when we first sat down. No. It wasn't like I became a neuroscientist because. I've always been a little heavy.
No problem. You know, but no, I am really interested in the imprinting, DNA imprinting from ancestors and so on. And, you know, do you know who Robert Svoboda is?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So he's part of our community. But so he wrote these three books, Agora books, the Left Hand of God people from India. And they're amazing. I mean, a lot of it, I mean, he was real, period. You read these books and you know, it's just incredible. The third book is called The Law of Karma. And in it, he talks exactly about the past, the DNA of the past incarnations and so on, in a different way, in the way of karma. That is being handed down and down and down and down, and you're absorbing, you, God knows, you know, how many generations back or however that would work.
Yeah, that would totally make sense, though, that DNA is karma. Like, you know, we think of it as like biology is
So
a separate thing than what manifests, you know, from the spirit. I mean, it's just, this is our container this lifetime. And, you know, there are sets of things that we'll take on. And I think it's, you know, and it's also the ways that we can change our karmas too. We can, you know, shift into greater compassion and awareness and, you know, go through each of our lessons as well.
Yeah, well, that's what we want to talk about here. Neurodiversity.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to get the most plain explanation of what this is, and what I'm looking forward to is being able to reconstitute the habitual patterns into something that's more, shall we say, productive in terms of getting free of, as it was told to us, kam, krodh, moh, loh, you know, greed, lust, you know, attachment. So there apparently is an opportunity for us, if we can realize it a little bit, that it is possible. Things can change. So tell us, how in the world can that happen?
Well, you first asked about neurodiversity.
Yeah. Well, so, we're going to start there because it's premised on right?
Yeah.
On that being the premise from which we can actually enact stuff, change, hopefully.
Yeah. And well, neurodiversity encompasses about 1 in 5 people. So it's about 20% of the population. And that includes people that have different brain wiring, basically. A big part of my book that I argue a lot more about is the fact that, in fact, we're all unique individuals, that we each come in with our very own brain print. So a really cool study that came out showed that when people were in a scanner, they looked at their brain and then they did this MRI. And in that, they did a very specific type of reconstruction and were able to parcelate out the brain in even better depth. So it offered about double the amount of uniqueness. And what they found is that they could match each brain with each individual. And so Raghu's brain prints are really different than Nicole's, even though we have, you know, this gross structures that are very, you know, we both have a frontal cortex. We both have, you know, these areas in our brain, in our visual systems, but then at the same time, they're unique to the way we think and process. Later on, what scientists also found too, by putting kids in a scanner, that they, between ages like 7 to 23, they showed them a model for learning. And in that, they looked at 17 different brain networks. And what they found was each individual had a different network lit up to the way that they learned. So what I really get at, you know, when I talk about neurodiversity, because there are absolute differences when we think about the way people think and process the world. And I really like to look at it through the lens of a strengths-based model rather than these are things we need to fix. Standard medical, you know, research science always wants to find a way to say how people are different. And if you're different, therefore you're less than. And a big part of the advocacy around neurodiversity is to say, no, different isn't less, it's just different. And there are so many beautiful strengths about it.
That's a byword for so much today. It's just different, right?
Yeah.
Around so many different issues. You know, I just misspoke because I'm such a newbie to all of this. Really, what I was thinking about when I said, you know, hey, we have the chance to change. I'm talking about basic change in patterns and so on, was the neural plasticity.
Yeah.
That is an encouraging thing. So let's talk, talk about that. That there is a reality there is amazing.
Yeah, we all have the ability for neuroplasticity. And in our life, we have these critical periods in our brain that allow for expanded brain growth. So a really cool thing is we know through development, you know, you have critical periods for language, you have this plasticity that comes about in adolescence. And we know that even into our mid-30s, the area that we do for all our thinking and all our processing, that frontal cortex develops. But what's even cooler is how meditation, how there's been practically over 16,500 papers that show the way that through different meditative practices, we can wire our minds and we can have neuroplasticity and we have these windows of opportunities to wire our mind for kind of more equanimity, compassion. And specifically, we know how meditation really is a doorway into the part of our brain that's really important for social connection, communication, and you know, developing these networks for greater trust and compassion for other people and for ourselves.
Isn't that where some of us started doing some substances and we found the truth of what you're saying?
Yeah.
Back in Ram Dass being a central advocate there?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's what's going on now. I mean, it is so, I mean, the reality of treating PTSD and death and addiction and so on with entheogens and people who are really learning how to guide in therapy, people that really need help and it's working, is a pretty fantastic thing.
Yeah. And the way, so the similarity that you have, so for example, when you think about meditation and like the phrase with Zen Buddhism, right, is that the beginner's mind. So like meditation, hallucinogenics provide a doorway for an opening of that critical period and that experience of that oneness. And so when you open up these critical periods, specifically for like social emotional connection and learning, you know, and you're in a therapeutic setting, or maybe not, you know, but you're close enough. Maybe you're with a
little set in setting takes place, shall we say, at the very least.
Yeah. And you kind of go in with the intention of knowing what you're going in for, you know, and what neural patterns you want to rewire. And especially, I mean, when you're in a therapeutic setting and you set it up with an intention, and you're processing what kind of can be rewired, what's so amazing about the doorway of a hallucinogenic is that it is opening up that critical period for that neuroplasticity to happen, where you can rewire new networks and let go of that trauma permanently.
Yeah.
And come into a space where you have more social connections with each other. And what's really interesting is with the process, like when we know that social emotional learning, there is a critical period, but in through our lives, we know, for example, that the serotonin kind of goes away over time, but with hallucinogenics, it opens it back up. So you get both, not just the social reward of the dopamine, but you get that serotonin where you get that reworking of that circuitry happening. Mm. And when that happens, you have that engagement again where you can kind of heal that trauma that you may have suffered.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, this is open. The door to it is open through practice, be it meditation, chanting, reading from the Bible. I mean, whatever it is, practice. I don't know why I said that. Do you know that we ended up in India with Ram Dass a second time? And all we heard about was Christ, and we started reading the Bible. I'd never read the Bible in my entire life, okay, on multiple reasons. A, I wasn't Christian, but, I mean, the Old Testament for sure. And now that seems like one of the greatest things I did. And we used to sit around with Ram Dass and we'd read from the Gospels. I mean, all the way back then. It's amazing. Anyhow, I don't know how we got there, except for the fact is that the door opens through practice for sure. And certainly psychedelics, as you say, there's a period of time. And most people take psychedelics profoundly, shall we say, when they're younger, right? I mean, that's the way it was. I think we still get mail. Hey, I took some psilocybin and someone gave me Be Here Now. Wow, I never heard of Ram Dass, you know, that kind of thing. So, so I guess that period, that formative period is extremely important. But now what about as we, you know, we get to middle age and we have well-developed habitual patterns, neurotic tendencies. We've got it all going. You know, the movie of me, which is this thing Duncan and I just put out. That is, how do we get to the movie of we is what we were speaking to, but then speak to it from the plasticity, the neuroplasticity for people that have, now you're in a really tough zone where you've got some solid shit that you could do.
Yeah. Well, I love that you say it's the movie of we, right? That's what psychedelics offers, that's what practice offers, is shifting out of that fear space and into the love space. And so what's so profound when we begin to practice, so like, let's just take chanting as a very simple practice of repeating mantra, right? When you're doing that, scientifically, you're reducing your fear circuitry. They show that people who are in Navy SEALs use mantra to reduce fear.
Really? I didn't know.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so when we just think about a simple act, and when you're talking about practice, and it goes all the way to reading the Gospels and seeing what Christ consciousness is, that it is love, right? It is what Ram Dass talked about for loving awareness. And coming into that space of love versus fear is what dissolves that separateness. And it's the same thing that psychedelics can do, where all of a sudden the I, the one, the me, the only me, my experience dissolves. And you sit in the space where you are one with everything. And that becomes a doorway that can enhance your practice. You don't have to do psychedelics at all. You can practice, and we know just through practice, you can wire your mind and have positive neuroplasticity and change it. I mean, you know, Sharon Salzberg talks about when she was doing, you know, metta meditation for a month, right? And after a month, she was like, this just isn't working. And she spilled something and she said, oh, you idiot, Sharon. And then she caught herself and said, you're not an idiot. You're okay. And it's that catching ourselves. It's that remembering and letting go of that self-critical voice that is so hard on us all the time. And that's kind of what all of these practices do for our neuroplasticity, is as we start to reduce that grip inside ourselves, all of a sudden that grip on other people, things don't matter as much. Yeah. Somebody being late, somebody making a mistake. All of a sudden it's, oh, we're in this together, you know, and that muscle of compassion comes in.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Sharon has an alter ego that she dumps all this shit on named Lucy. Oh, Lucy, what did you do there? What was that all about?
Well, we need that. We need we need something to dump it, and that's okay.
Someone to dump it into. That's so great. Talk about, you have one thing called mirror, mirror, but the mirror neuron system, this is, you know, this is actually quite important in terms of reflection and so on. So yeah, talk about that.
Well, I mean, this is like pivotal, like of everything you first did with Ram Dass, right? When you met him and you gaze into one another's eyes and the whole exercise of eye gazing and looking and letting down those defenses. So scientifically, we know that we see each other in our minds. So there are these neurons in our brain called mirror neurons, and they activate every time we see somebody doing something we can imagine we're doing. So they're kind of the cornerstone of what you would call theory of mind. And when we think about that, and somebody's suffering, right? And there's, and we have empathy, these neurons fire. And so the more in tune we are with others' experiences, the more awareness we have that is activated. And it's how we see one another, that you and I are one, in fact. And rather than, you know, it dissolves a bit of that separateness. And we can have that interconnection more and more as we, you know, like the Mirabai Bush's and Ram Dass's, just like me, right? The Just Like Me meditation is a direct reflection to activate the mirror neuron system. And for us to see other beings suffer too, you know?
Yeah, well, empathy is, of course, immediately present. There's no way, unless you're a complete, you know, there are many devastatingly wounded people in this world who have no relationship with outside themselves.
Sure.
But for the most part, that is true. We all have that deep down inside. And the development of it, in my mind, is through practice that turns from empathy into compassion, which is a more active principle for people to end up in a situation where that is how we recognize each other as all being part of the one, is through compassion. So Ram Dass has talked a lot about, there's some great stuff, anybody out there want, in terms of Ram Dass related to compassion and generosity. It's quite wonderful.
Yeah, and when you think, when you're talking about compassion, it's really the most skillful means in action, right? A difference between empathy, a core difference between empathy and compassion for me is, you know, the example, like a child skids and hurts themselves, right? And has, you know, bumps into a wall and they're crying. Empathy is feeling it with them and crying with them. Or if you want to have compassion, you relieve their suffering. You offer them a hug. You rub the area where they've been injured. And so that's kind of the difference, where compassion is the action, the most qualified action in that moment, which can change from time to time. And so when you're talking about generosity and compassion, that comes back to the loop in the sense that when we have altruistic actions that are for the benefit of all beings, that in itself enhances our compassion, but not only that, that enhances our long-term reward system. So those are like the helping, you know, where you get the helper's high, right? Because you get a positive dopamine rush rather than, you know, a transient, you know, it's a long lasting, because you're part of something bigger than yourself. You're connected to other things, versus a transient one where you go and you, you know, get yourself a brand new car, you know, that wears off.
Yeah.
Whereas a long-term act of generosity really has the effect that it's intended for. And I mean, even when you think about generosity and the cycle of it, it is really just sharing. Like you even think about, I think about how Maharaji would say to you, you know, all the money in the world is mine. And like for a being to think that, and then you think about different spiritual teachers that have used that in a very unique way and position themselves, for example, you know, Osho.
Yeah, no, that's just human reality. There's no accounting or understanding any of that. But with Neem Karoli Bhava, we understood without our minds, and to be able to express it, of course, we have to use our minds. But he was, that place that he was coming from wasn't a, there was no polarization of a me and a you. All money in the world is mine. It's impossible to understand that. Maybe if you are really lost your ego on acid, maybe you get a glimpse, and that's all you get is a glimpse. But I mean, I'm kidding. But the reality is, that's what this whole, the book I did with Duncan was the movie of me to the movie of we. And how do we get to the movie of we? Well, it was, and in the end, and we've had a lot of great, you know, references to many different teachers, whatever. And in the end, it was Ram Dass. It was an excerpt I took. It's so beautiful. It was around generosity and compassion. And the way those two tie together, because when that is existent, even for a moment, you are no longer involved with the I, me, me, me. You aren't, because you're going to, in the case you were talking, you're going to help the child one way or the other. You're taking the action. As soon as you do that, you are not thinking of me, me, me anymore. And you are in part of that incredible, infinite structure of the universe of souls, or you can call them anything you want. Souls is just one word to identify that who we are that is beyond these momentary excursions into an incarnation. Mm. I also wanted to, you talk about anxiety. So this, here's another thing that everybody can agree on. We all get anxiety day to day, part of being human. So, but you were pointing out that there's a very appropriate anxiety and part of our DNA about what keeps us alive. And yet there's an anxiety that we don't need to take on. Yeah, talk about it from the neuroscience point of view.
Well, when we think about anxiety, I mean, it's always been categorized as it's not healthy. The reality is that transient anxiety that we can have rise up, you know, gets us to wake up, you know, get to our desk, do our job, you know, is an element that we, you know, we have a deadline, we have to get something done. The persistent anxiety that can exist is very different. You know, and transient anxiety lasts 40 minutes. So anything that persists longer than that becomes really unhealthy on our nervous system, where we get an influx of inflammation. And that inflammation that we can have is not solely happening in our brain, but it's happening throughout our body, where we can experience, you know, physical manifestations. We could get headaches, we can get backaches, you know, wherever it kind of resonates in the body. And so when we think about anxiety and the relationship of the kind of world we live in, you know, especially when we think about these global events that are occurring, when we think about, you know, climate crisis, you know, we can have our nervous system primed for the worst case scenario. And, you know, I kind of, you know, I'm going to talk about this in a sideways, because in a scientific perspective, there's this whole idea that there's this negativity bias, that in terms of the way that our brains are primed, that we are out there to see danger, and we don't live, you know, out in the Saharas anymore. And so there isn't as much immediate danger. There isn't that lion that is in Raghu's office right now or here.
And in the lion just attacked somebody not that far away, a few miles, took their dog, and they had to chase the lion. Okay, so this is not that.
Oh, yeah. Do you have mountain lions?
Yeah. Scary. I don't know what to do. I mean, can you imagine? These two guys chased the mountain lion up the hill and screaming and going crazy. It had the dog in its mouth, and they managed to scare it away. And they got the dog back.
Did the dog survive?
Survived. Wow. Unbelievable. A second time I've heard about this in the local news in 2 months, not more. Okay. So we're back to the Sahara, I got to tell you.
So strike everything I just said.
But I know what you mean. Yes. We went through, you know, into the industrial age, what, 200 years ago or something? Nothing really in the scope of time, and here we are. We don't know what the hell we're doing and what's going on, and the anxiety's taken a different shape, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. So there are real mountain lions in the case of Raghu. And actually in the local mountains here too. But yeah, in general, but like you're saying, the anxiety has taken a new, you could feel it, you breathe it, it's in the air. And so when we come back to how to shift out of that, it really comes back to our practice and the basic uses of how we can wire our minds out of that and recognize what elements of anxiety are productive for us and which are really pulling us out, right? Because the whole point of be here now, whether it's thoughts of anxiety and that, it, you know, we didn't talk about this, but we have close to like 60,000 thoughts a day.
Yeah.
So.
Ouch.
Some of us could have even more, right? You're going to say, well, no, I have 100,000. And so, but when you think about that, like that is super freaking intense. And so where we focus our attention, where we focus our awareness is the piece that matters when it comes to how to calm our nervous systems back down, or at least witness and acknowledge it. And there's this one study, so that came out that was really pivotal, and it showed it was at UC Berkeley, where they identified that we have close to 27 core emotions. And what they found was transient anxiety lasts close to 40 minutes, like I said. And then simultaneously, they found that the longest standing emotion was sadness, and it lasted 130 hours.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah. And in contrast, wow. And in contrast to that, gratitude lasts 5 hours and joy lasts up to 35 hours. So this is kind of where the concept of the work of Rick Hansen really comes in, where we can kind of prime our nervous system and start to think about taking in the good. So as not as a spiritual bypass, not to not acknowledge when suffering arises. So there was this one time I literally was giving a talk about the nervous system and our emotions. And right before I got on a plane to go speak, I found out somebody had passed away. Mm. And I was like, oh, gosh, you know, and I realized I had to show up. And then I thought about the study and I said, okay, there's 130 hours. That's sadness. It's not grief. But I thought sadness is one of the stages. And that gave me a little, just enough to recenter my mind and say, okay, this is impermanent. It's not going to last forever. I could get on the plane, I could do this talk, and it's going to be okay. And it allowed me to have, so it's sort of like having the information that the science could say, okay, there is an actual endpoint to this suffering, and then using whatever practice it is that gets you to shift your awareness into the space of being able to witness it and not be consumed by it, really is that space where the anxiety doesn't become the story.
Yeah, yeah. Making, you know, friends with impermanence, uncertainty is what the development we would hope that everybody could get to with some practice. So you're not, yes, you're going to immediately react if someone passes and you get that information and you're in the midst of whatever else you have to do related to other humans who are counting on you or whatever. And there is a moment that suddenly there's spaciousness and you can be with both things. That's what Ram Dass used to say. I've said this a billion times on podcasts. He used to say, you can be on more than one plane of consciousness at the same time. So you can be in the sadness of that moment and grief, and you can be in the moment where we are not separate and nothing begins nor ends. And that's a difficult thing, especially in of course, if someone passing like that, that's very difficult. But it's ultimately, I've seen him, he did it. I've seen him do it personally. Ram Dass. Absolutely. When our good friend's daughter passed, he was right with him. And Ram Dass was completely here, not disparaging the horrible grief and sadness of, in this case, losing a child, but also being in the place that she is not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So these things are possible. That's all. I just want to make sure everybody understands. Yes, it's possible, absolutely possible, to go inside and work on oneself to have that kind of an outcome. And he was living proof of it.
And he taught you so much on how to be living proof in ways.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I wouldn't be here without him for sure. And I'm, you know, he's been gone, what, 4 years? I'm living proof that, you know, or it is living proof that that is real. He hasn't gone anywhere. Because I have to talk to him all the time. Because I used to on the phone. Now I have to do it on another plane of consciousness. And he's quite there in terms of all of the ways in which I used to call him and say, look, my self-interest is involved here. What am I going to do about this? You know, ambition, whatever it might be. And he just laughed, you know. And he, without saying a word sometimes, he would just undercut this kind of self-seriousness, right? Which is a problem for us. Hey, do you want to talk about the...
You always want to keep changing.
Yeah.
No, I love what you're talking about, though, because it's, I mean, when you think about it, it's like, I never met Ram Dass in the body, but I talk to him all the time, too. And he's so alive. You know, he's alive through all the books, through all your podcasts, through all your teachings about him. I mean, loving awareness is, I mean, it's him, you know, it's in every like fabric that I feel is part of Love, Serve, Remember and all these different podcasts where, you know, it's different voices, it's different perspectives, and it's also the one singular voice. And
see, this is a testimonial, everybody out there, so it won't get any better than this. I couldn't do it better myself if I tried. Okay? It's a testimonial for what Love, Serve, Remember really is. Just like Be Here Now is beyond the aphorism. Into a, you know, something that without that, it's going to be a very difficult life. So, we're very fortunate. And his thing was all about sharing. So remember you mentioned that before? This kind of sharing it's an intimate way for us to open up with everybody around us. Is sharing. And that's what Ram Dass represents. He couldn't stop sharing. He was told, don't share. Don't tell anybody about me, Neem Karoli Baba said. And that's all he did. And he later said to me, how could I not share that jewel? You know, it's impossible. So that's true compassion. So that's what we're trying to point out here. There's a possibility that we can all change enough of these patterns that we have and come from a little bit of a different perspective. And it's amazing how real change is. It's real.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I want to hear about the gut, and the last thing here, because we don't have much time, the gut and the brain connection. I got a real problem with that.
Oh, well,
I have terrible digestion issues that I'm getting treated for. Because of India, mostly. Mm. India killed me dead that way. It was worth it, though. But, yeah, talk about the gut and the brain. I very well understand the basic principle, but I think it's a good thing for all of us to understand.
Well, when we think about the gut-brain connection, so really quick, one thing we were talking about with anxiety really quick that I want to say from a physiological standpoint that I forgot to mention is literally when we take three deep breaths. So we're talking about the love space versus the fear space. Mm. When we take three deep breaths, we have that release of positive neurochemicals of oxytocin and vasopressin, which are two neurotransmitters which increase our trust and our sense of connection with others. And it also kind of opens up to be more spacious. Like literally our body vasodilates. So you have less constriction. You have more oxygen flow happening all throughout your body. And so just taking three simple deep breaths like changes our physiology and shift us out of that anxiety. Yeah. And the way that can relate when we're thinking about the gut-brain connection. So we have, on average, 100 billion neurons. And then in our gut, we have close to 700 million neurons. So like the size of a cat brain lives in our belly. And what's even more crazy about that is there are neurotransmitters specifically. So when we're talking about rewiring our minds, we have close to 90% of our serotonin is made by our gut. So that's our kind of social, emotional, feel good hormone. And then 50% of our dopamine is made that way. And that's kind of our reward. So when we think about a dysregulation or when the gut is not happy, that's going to vastly affect our mental states. The other complicated factor about our gut is that 70% of our immunity is made in our GI. So those immune cells also have a really important element in terms of neuroinflammation and the way that you have that directional, bidirectional kind of things happening between the gut and the brain. Mm. And you know, Shiva and Shakti. So if Shakti is not happy in your gut, then, you know, the awareness is going to be really hard.
Mm. That's a simple, direct way to put it. Yes.
But, And so the other complicating thing too, is like the microbiome that we have, and what we're learning so much more is having a happy gut. So having good microbes, healthy microbes can really combat chronic GI issues and can increase positive mood. So like researchers at UCLA simply found taking probiotics can reduce anxiety and increase a sense of well-being and positive mental health.
Mm. Mm. Food for thought.
Huh? I like that. Yeah.
There's a great thing. We can go out on this. You put a quote in here from Gandhi. Gandhiji. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one summer when we were with Neem Karoli Baba, we went all up to Kosani to a Gandhi ashram where he had written one of his books. And we all stayed, about 20, 30 people stayed there and did this, you know, I don't know, couple of month thing. I don't know how. He just got rid of us because any chance he could to get rid of us, he took. However, that really works is another thing. But Gandhi was very important to us. Your beliefs become your thoughts. Your thoughts become your words. Your words become your actions. Your actions become your habits. Your habits become your values. Your values become your destiny. I never, ever came across that. And it's so fantastic. Where'd you find that? Remember?
I think it was in one of his books I was searching.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's incredible. Hey, Nicole, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Raghu, for having me.
Absolutely. And we'll, the book is available, right?
But we know we didn't do it, so it's all okay.
Yeah, no, no.
It's the story of we.
I don't believe any of that. the book is available still, correct?
Yeah, yeah. So on all major areas, wherever you
So we'll put a link to Amazon or whatever there. And you'll let me
know. And I'm going to have a study guide coming out later this year, and the audiobook is coming out.
Study, did you say?
A study guide, yeah.
For, what is that going to be?
It's to kind of lead a parent and educator and psychology groups on how to talk about these different things in school systems for advocacy for their children.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Good. All right. Well, whatever else you let me know, and we'll put it in the show notes. Everybody, you can go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling, and we are put all the links and little surmisal of everything, so you can share that with everybody, and you can find out what else is up on the Be Here Now Network. We've got some surprising and wonderful new podcasts coming up. So yeah, get yourself signed on to the newsletter. That'll be good. And we shall see you next week. Thanks again, Nicole. Thank you.
Thank you.